The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to be able to speak to Gaurav Narain of River Global, who runs the India Capital Growth Fund and is one of the country's finest investors. So welcome, Gaurav.
Yeah, hi, Paul.
Well, most UK people are probably pretty unfamiliar about investing in India. I certainly am anyway. And I suppose we can start there. If you could just quickly run through what the sort of key differences and attractions of putting money to work in the country.
Yeah, I think India is a very different market from the UK. I think other than the GDP, which is very similar to the UK. But India is really, I would say, a very complex country as such. So to just give a perspective, India has about 29 states, and you should look at each state as a country in Europe, because the language is different, culture is different, food habits are different. So it's really a very, very diverse country. So to do business in a country like India, you got to understand the nuances of India in the first place. I think the second big difference between India and with India is that it's the demographics. It's a very young population. I'd say there are about 600 million people below 25 years of age.
Wow.
So for India, demographics is the least of its worries, and aging population is the least of its worries. I think the biggest challenge the country faces is that you will actually be getting almost 100 million people into the working force over the next decade. So you got to create jobs. So I think that's the bigger challenge for India. I think the third thing about India, which people should realize, is that it's a fairly well-regulated country. Not just a democracy, but all its major institutes, be it the Central Bank of India, be it the capital markets regulator. Every sector has a fairly strong regulator. And even the legal system, though it's very slow, but it operates.
Yeah.
So there is legal recourse in India. So I'd really put it as a sense that this is the nature of the economy. But I would say the biggest difference today between India and what you see in UK and the rest of the world is the growth factor.
Yeah.
That India is possibly one of the fastest growing economies in the world. In fact, today it's growing faster than China. It's the fifth largest economy and projected to be the third largest over the next decade. So really, that's the story about India, that it's a complex country, but it's growing and it's delivered even in the past on growth.
Yeah, it does seem to be sort of like going for about sort of 6% per annum GDP real growth. So it is absolutely flying. Just on the politics, in the UK, we've got a general election probably towards the back end of next year. I understand you guys have as well towards May, in the middle of 2024. What sort of backdrop is there with it's President Modi, I think it is. What is he supportive of business and growth and the rule of law?
Yeah. I think Modi's done wonders for the economy. And I'll go back a bit. Yes, we have elections next year, most likely in May. But till 2014, in every election, you used to see a coalition government. So, you had a multi-party system and, no one party, one majority. But what happened in 2014, that's when the Modi government came to power, and it came with a single party majority. And what they did was they used that as an opportunity to actually do a lot of reforms. Very tough decisions were taken, but the whole idea of these reforms was really to bring about transparency in the economy, use technology, reduce the role of the bureaucrat. And that's what's changed India. Along with this, a lot of digitization happened. And fortunately, the government got re-elected with a majority again in the 2019 election. So we virtually had a 10-year period where a lot of tough decisions have been made, which is where the economy is quite resilient. And the impact is being witnessed, which is why in the upcoming elections, the probability of the Modi government coming to power again with a majority is very high. So the market is really factoring in that, you know, we may have possibly another stable government period and a very reform-oriented, a very business-friendly government in place.
Good. Okay. In terms of the actual economy, you mentioned obviously the demographics are very supportive with the young workforce, or 100 million people extra coming into the workforce. I wish we could have that in the UK. We've only got a 70 million population, but we really struggle. Yeah. So on top of the sort of the positive demographics of India, what else are sort of the secular growth trends in India to keep consistently hitting out the sort of the 5 or 6%, both internally and externally?
Yeah, I think I'll just take you back a bit, and I mentioned the reform side of it. What the government really did was virtually every sector underwent reforms, right from change in the entire taxation system, your new bankruptcy code, real estate sector reforms. As I mentioned, it's all about transparency. What that did was that the old way of doing business collapsed. Many business houses which used to play one the bank versus the other, or try and leverage on their political relations, all that collapsed. So the banking sector took a big hit at one point of time. So between 2014 to 2019, you had so much uncertainty due to these reforms that I would say the non-performing assets of the banking system went to an all-time almost 6%. And then the cleanup started. The same happened with corporate profitability. A lot of consolidation, companies delevered. So what eventually happened was by 2019, in the first 4 or 5 years of reforms, you'd seen a spike, a really collapse in the banking system and corporate profitability. But today, both banks and corporate India are sitting on the healthiest ever balance sheet. They're delevered, banks are sitting on the best asset quality ever. So that's one change which happened. The second was that the government also rolled out their public digital infrastructure. And what's different is that between India and the rest of the world is that in India, the digital infrastructure is owned by the government. So it's very low cost and very high volume. And they what they did was they actually started right from the base, where they created an identity for every individual, because they found that you know, if you were in rural India or a small town, you may not have had a birth certificate, no proof, no actually documentation to prove who you were. So it started with the identity card called Aadhaar, a 12-digit number which has everything from your photograph to your retina scan to your fingerprint. And that's today used as a eKYC. So a bank account can be opened in 30 seconds flat. And it's made the whole economy very efficient, because you then opened 400 million bank accounts across the country. Every household had an account. You then launched what is your payment gateway, which is a free peer-to-peer, business-to-peer, business-to-business gateway. Today, it does over 11 billion transactions a month. 45% of global real-time transactions happen in India. And on top of that layer, they've rolled out a data layer. So today, I would say if I want to go get a housing loan, when I go to my banker, all I do is give him the consent, and he can pick up all my data right from my bank statements, my insurance policies, virtually every digital data through the government records, right from source. Based on that, he can approve loans. I mean, no paperwork. But what has made a big difference is to the small shopkeeper who had no documentation. Today, through this process, the lender can pick up a lot of his data right from the rent receipts he does, etc. So even if he's not paying taxes, and has no formal balance sheet or P&L account, banks are able to deliver loans. So it's really democratized India. Part of the economy which was not formalized has come into mainstream. So that's the foundation. And today the whole focus is on growth. So we've had infrastructure being laid out. $1.8 trillion worth of projects are being implemented. Have a look at Mumbai, where I sit. Mm-hmm. About $50 billion worth of projects being implemented in Mumbai itself, right from a greenfield airport, 11 metro lines, a bridge across the sea, 22 kilometers. Delhi is seeing a new greenfield airport. The 25 cities where metros are coming up. So that's the big change that you've created a background. Your government's pushing on infrastructure. And for the corporate sector also, a lot of incentive schemes. It's targeted at specific sectors where India is a very large manufacturing, very large market, but is importing a lot of products. Or we have inherent strengths in manufacturing and want India to be a big global base. So all that, the foundation is done, and now it's real growth, and you're actually seeing it in numbers today.
Those are all those are largely, obviously, sort of secular and the demographics and urbanization you talked about and digitization. In terms of the external, how important is sort of external finance and also the sort of like these, unfortunately, the last 2 or 3 years, the US and China haven't gone on too well. And there is actually a noticeable shift to India in terms of sort of like industrialization. You've seen Apple moving a lot of its iPhone production to India. Can you just talk quickly about sort of the external factors that are also adding on to the sort of the dynamic growth in locally?
So what's really happened is because of the sort of investments or the sort of changes that have happened, India's now because of the growth, it's also leading to a lot of and I would also add the geopolitics. All this is happening when geopolitics is actually favoring India, largely because people want to diversify out of China, and suddenly India becomes very attractive simply because your infrastructure has improved, your regulatory environment has improved dramatically. All taxation, etc., are at par with the best in the world. And so everything's coming into place. And today, as the global world is looking at finding alternatives, you have this one economy, which is massive, a massive domestic economy, but also a very low-cost economy to be a big manufacturing powerhouse. So you're seeing it all happen. Infrastructure through the government and these policies encouraging this flow in. So if you take a simple sector like, say, mobile manufacturing, India is a market of 180 million phones in a year. 4 years back, we were importing all our phones. Today, 100% of phones are assembled in India. Apple is already started manufacturing everything till the iPhone 15. They're exporting $1 billion worth of phones a month out. They're shifting 25% of their global production into India. And it's not just Apple. Motorola has done the same thing. You're seeing Samsung has set up its largest ever global manufacturing facility in India. So it's really not the global players, but the domestic players also seeing a huge benefit out of it. And so for India, really, it's the domestic story. And in a very weak global environment, what we are seeing, a lot of our corporates are seeing very strong growth in exports as well because of this reallocation of supply chains which are happening.
And I guess there's also sort of a big shift to electrification as well, isn't there? Because obviously, I know India is sort of the air quality and stuff like that to sort of clean it up. But there's a big shift, I think, to sort of like a, well, to try and get the electric vehicles and, sort of like particularly the two wheelers. I know they're quite popular out there.
So I think there's a lot happening on the environment side. One is, of course, India trying to move to a renewable energy market, where there itself India has a target of 500 gigawatts of renewable energy by 2027. So India suddenly become the largest market for solar power. But having said that, the private sector has taken a lot of initiatives also, and especially on electric vehicles. I think India is becoming a very big base for two-wheeler electrical manufacturing EVs, and you're already seeing over 1 million two-wheeler EVs sold last year, and that's really growing at a very fast pace. So India's taken a lead there. A lot of technology innovations globally is happening in India on the two-wheeler side. I think on the four-wheeler side, it's a slightly different story. I think one has to realize India is a very price-sensitive market. So currently, while a lot of capacities are being set up, in terms of absolute numbers, it's still minuscule. I would say it's less than 1% of four-wheeler sales. But there will be an inflection point, and I think you know, it's just that a lot of companies are just waiting for being able to produce at a right price point. Otherwise, you know, it's just not viable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's lots to. We're going to pick through some of those with some of those stock areas that you've invested in the fund, etc. But just broad picture, I mean, in the UK, we sort of like. I mean, I think the analysts are expecting 6 or 7% corporate earnings growth the next 2 years. So not exactly stellar. We've got the S&P, which is always sort of like 10 to 12% sort of projecting for corporate earnings. And I did see it, I don't know if you correct this, but India seems to be projecting sort of like, you know, company growth in earnings per share of into the sort of low 20s for the next 2 or 3 years. Is that right?
You're bang on. In fact, if you take the top 50 companies, the earnings for this year is projected at close to 21%. If you look at our own portfolio, we own about 34 stocks in our portfolio. The aggregate earnings of our portfolio is about 25% this year, as well as 25% the year after. And last year, we delivered about 27% earnings. Now, that's just numbers. But if you look at the broad economy, we just had a second quarter GDP numbers come out. The GDP grew real terms at 7.6% in the previous quarter. In the first quarter, it grew at the quarter prior, it grew at 7.8%. So in the first half of the year itself, the GDP has grown at about 7.7%. What we are actually seeing is a very surprising trend, which we've not seen earlier, is that invariably you start with X numbers and over the every quarter you downgrade numbers by 2 to 3%. I think for the last three quarters, it's the reverse has actually happened. Everything from the GDP numbers to earnings estimates, you're actually being upgraded because companies are delivering better than what you'd expected. It normally doesn't happen when you're trying to do numbers. You always start at a optimistic level and then tone down. So that's the real story of India, that things are really moving and it's reflecting across sectors, you know, which is where there's a lot of confidence that this is not a short term, it's actually structural, it's sustainable, and that's where the confidence is arising.
Yeah, well, I wish I'd invested in the India capital growth 5 years ago, because I was just doing the numbers before we chatted, and the fund has nearly doubled actually over the last 5 years, which is a compound average growth rate of just south of 15% per annum, and it's beaten the S&P 500, which is up about 70 or 80% over that period. But the UK, we haven't even over the last 5 years have just got back to less than 10% in terms of the all share. Or the FTSE 250, so you've really knocked the ball out the park in terms of performance for the last, and that's in pound sterling terms, not even in local currency. So given that, I mean, you've set the bar really high, Gareth. So we're not going to give you a difficult question here, but going forward, what's sort of outlook for Indian equities and sort of like how you're positioning it? Because there's so many sort of like growth drivers. And I know one of the concerns of investors is that India isn't cheap anymore. And I know it trades at sort of low 20s, but when you put it through the lens of a P sort of like, earnings per share growing up by 23, 24%, it has a PEG ratio of less than one. So when you put it through that lens, it's actually damn sight cheaper than the UK, and the UK is the cheapest in the Western world.
Yeah. No, I think if you ask me, you know, the biggest concerns today you have is on valuations. You know, the fact is that virtually every time period you look at India, the price to earnings multiples have re-rated. So if you look at a decade back, the market was trading at about 14 times. Today, it's trading at about 20 times. But having said that, we look at our own stocks. You know, we look at it from a very bottom-up perspective and look at each stock from the growth and what should be the fair value. I would say the market, from my perspective, on a one-year perspective, markets are clearly fully valued. You know, in absolute returns, possibly only about 40% of my stocks would see an absolute upside on one-year forward earnings. And almost 25% more than a 5% downside. But the I think the so the story really is, will India deliver on growth? So the moment you move, you know, today you're almost close to the end of the financial year, so you'll start moving to the next financial year and look at, you know, FY26, start looking at FY26 numbers. When you start doing that, you suddenly find there's a big upside again. So there is, what I sense is that, you know, earnings will again play catch up. And that's really what's been having. A lot of the performance you talked about, there is a big element of earnings growth, which has also been driving this market. So the key to watch out for us is really, will this earnings growth be sustainable? Is it a flash in the pan? And the sense we get it, it's not the case. I think for the next 3-4 years, we have a lot of comfort that this what's already on the ground will deliver. So if you, my own sense is, don't get bogged down by these 1 year valuations. Look at India from a 3 year perspective, and then you'll again start seeing a fair amount of value. Yeah. And I'll again go back in time. You know, you started by saying India has been one of the strongest performers. If you correlate it with the nominal GDP growth of India over the last decade, India's nominal GDP growth has compounded at 9.8% over the last decade in dollar terms. And my sense is, given the sort of reforms we've already seen and the changes we've already seen, this growth will be higher going forward. So if you're actually looking at even 11 to 12% nominal GDP growth in dollar terms, build in a corporate earnings growth of anywhere between 13 to 15%, so, you know, if nothing else, you're doing nothing stupid and just playing the earnings growth story, in rupee terms, you should actually be compounding at 13 to 15% over a long period of time. That's how I would say it. Ideally, you should be playing a portfolio which is growing slightly faster than that and build in a bit of currency depreciation. But the story is really of earnings growth. And India has delivered in the past, which is why its markets over a long period have done well. And my sense is India is possibly the best positioned now to deliver in the future as well.
Good. Okay, brilliant. And what sort of companies or what sort of features do you look for in particular stocks in India? I know you go, it's sort of the mid-cap, small cap, but just to give people a bit of sort of insight, it still has a average market cap of about $1.5 billion, so they're not exactly small companies. We're not talking of there's reasonable liquidity in them, I guess.
So I have everything from $100 million dollars upwards, and the median market cap today would be about $1.7 billion. But what we are really trying to look at is, you know, I would say we are a very, very bottom up investors. Everything we buy, we look at owning for at least 3 to 5 years. In fact, if you look at our portfolio today, over 65% of my portfolio I've held for over 5 years. So what are we looking at? So we are very clear. Our belief is there's no shortage of growth opportunities in India. It's just that you've got to play with the right businesses. So we are very conscious of what we want to invest in. So our first criteria is really that, on the management, you have to buy managements which are trustable, no corporate governance issue, but strong leadership. I think the second factor we look at is, again, on the quality of the business. The business should really be scalable, and it should have some USP or entry barrier which gives it that pricing power and the comfort to us that the earnings growth is predictable. And the third thing we look at is cash flows. That we will never buy a business which historically has not delivered positive free cash flows. The inherent ability to deliver free cash is very, very critical for us. So we just stick to these three basics of investing. And what we try and do is anything we find which is very complex, which is very too globally linked, which we have no advantage, wherever we have management concerns, we just put it in what we call our blacklist. So we are not wasting our time on those businesses. But the whole intent is play the India growth story. We trade very little. You know, our portfolio turnover is just about 10 to 12%. So the idea is find one great business and just let it compound over time. So the whole game is play the India compounding story, and that's how we built our portfolio.
Good. You don't have a family relative in Omaha, Nebraska, do you? Because you sound very familiar to a young gentleman who's about 94, I think, Mr. Buffett out there.
You'd be surprised, the Indian, the mature, I would say, most of us joined this industry somewhere in the early 90s. And you'll find most investors are very, very Warren Buffett influenced. And I mean, that's quite a trend you'll find in India, that, you know, you buy quality and ride it for the long term.
Yeah, well, I think you've even beat his returns over the last 5 years. So well done. Now let's move to a sector that I think is your largest one, the banking sector. And I guess this is the beneficiary that you talked about with the sort of like the digitization, the access to credit growth, etc. And you've got sort of three companies there. You've got Federal Bank, you've got IDFC and Indu. Sind,
yeah.
Which is all three sort of like, you know, big banks there, which I guess play at various levels. Can you just take us three quickly those three companies?
Sure. You know, what we are doing, banking is, I would say, our largest exposure, and we've actually got five banks in our portfolio, the largest being Federal Bank. You know, this is a very conservative bank. I would say its book is about one third is large corporates, one third is small and medium corporates, and one third is retail. But a very high quality book. Even in retail, they focus largely on a very secured book like mortgages, gold loans, etc. Now this bank has been growing its book at about 18 to 20%. It has return on assets of about 1.3 times, ROE of about 15-16%, and we actually see its non-performing assets is less than 1%. It's got excess provisioning in its book, and you're actually in a phase of an economy where all three legs are growing, and a very conservative bank in terms of the quality of its book. And where can you get a bank like this where it's, you know, it's trading at just about 1.1 time book value? So it's almost a 6% weight in my portfolio. And this is something, you know, we'll possibly hold for a long period of time because we actually don't see asset quality issues come for quite some time in India. Mm. I think at the other extreme, we have a bank called the IDFC First. Now, this is really more of a retail bank. I would rate it as on one of the best digital lenders. Its pedigree is it used to be a non-bank finance company till it merged with a small bank to get the banking license. But it's at the forefront of digital-based lending. So it's really using the sort of data you're getting as to doing hundreds of data points to build algorithms to lend to the retail. It's a very wide portfolio of retail lenders. But this is a bank which is actually growing at 25%. It has net interest margins of almost 6%. And yet its non-performing assets, again, are less than 1%. So it's one with a very strong history of retail lending, digital lending, and one of the fastest growing banks as well. A very strong management team, again, which actually gives us the biggest comfort. So here you have two extremes. IndusInd Bank, actually today I would call a large cap bank. And the reason it's in our portfolio is that we've held it for several years. But this again is, I would say, a 65% retail, 45% wholesale book. But here it's retail, it's, you know, number one vehicle finance lender. It's one of the largest microfinance lenders and on the corporate side. So it's playing a very different segment of the market. But here also, you know, his return on assets is about 1.7%. What I'd really like to highlight about the entire banking space today is that all the banks are very well capitalized. They're sitting on the best ever asset quality. Market environment is strong. They've all come out of a phase where, you know, they were forced to look inwards because of the reform side. So really, it's a scenario where The only challenge is on the liability side, because your growth will really be restricted to how you're able to attract low-cost liabilities. So I think the environment is very strong, and valuations is one sector where they're trading well below historical averages. So which is why it's actually our largest weight in our portfolio today.
Yeah, well, with a growing economy and positive sort of demographics, then you'd have thought it's a very good environment. There's a lot of opportunities to put lending or put investment into companies, certainly to give loans, etc., profitably. And if the return on capital employed is sort of 15% plus generally across the sector, I mean, in the UK, we struggle to get 10%. So it isn't, the valuations are not that dissimilar. Another sector that seems to be a big theme is sort of consumer products, etc. And we've got Jaitholi Labs, we've got Imami, Kajaria Ceramics, CCLL Products, and Wellspun. Do you want to take us through just a few of these? What sort of like attraction of their sort of like consumer? I'm guessing it's as you get that mass affluence being sort of like, you know, part of the actual economy as people move from rural into urbanization, better paid jobs, and want the lifestyles of the West, I guess.
Yeah. No, so actually consumer has always been, I think, the core of our portfolio. It's always ranged anywhere above 20% of our portfolio. And simply because the demographics story is going to play out for decades into India. And as you mentioned, you know, you have at the bottom of the pyramid is a very poor population. But every increase in incomes goes straight into consumption and they keep moving up the value chain. So we are playing several themes. It actually started, if you ask me, 3 years back, it was a very staples heavy portfolio. Today, it's moved more towards a discretionary heavy portfolio. And you mentioned quite a few names.
Let's start with Jeitholi, because it's basically a personal products company, I think, that does sort of beauty and cosmetics and all that kind of stuff. And I guess that as people sort of like want to go out and enjoy themselves and look a bit better, it's a big beneficiary. It's got a big competitor, I imagine, probably called Hindustan Lever out there, I imagine. But it's doing well, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, it's core businesses. It's into soaps, detergents. It's the market leader in dishwash. It's also the market leader in a niche product called fabric wash, for collars, etc. It's a fairly unique market. Now, if you look at its turnover, and it's also the second largest player in household insecticides. About 7-8 years back had acquired the Henkel brand portfolio in India as well. So it's a fairly diversified business. But if you look at its turnover, it's about $300 million in revenue. Hindustan Unilever, $8 billion in revenue. Okay. What it's doing is that Jyoti is, even in a, I think consumption has been slightly weak in India because of the inflation. But Jyoti continues, it's actually the fastest growing consumer company over the last 3 years. It's been growing its revenues at over 11 or 12% in a fairly weak environment. So it is one of the fastest growing consumer businesses. And the opportunity set, as I mentioned, is very large. And in India, most consumer businesses have very high return on capital employed because your working capital is almost is zero to negative. So it's one of those businesses which you're actually seeing, you know, revenues growing double digits, profits growing actually over 20% because, you know, its margins are expanding as it's scaling up. So it's a great consumption story. And, you know, we've owned it for well over 5 years and we expect to, just have it playing. At the other end, you know, we have another company called Imami. Now, this is a very niche business. For example, it's into what is called Ayurvedic products, which are now very big in the UK and Western world.
It's what products, sorry?
Ayurvedic. These are made of herbs, etc. So natural ingredients, as they call it. But so it's created very niche categories in this segment, right from skincare to pain relief, etc. and it's a market leader there. So what it has is it's actually being able to generate gross margins of almost 67 to 70%. Its operating margins are somewhere around 27-odd%. Imagine a consumer business having such metrics. So it's very niche. It's actually had a slight weak run over the last 3 years because of COVID and the impact of inflation on the poorer section of the economy. But it's really used these last 3 years to really build out a very strong digital platform. In financial year 21 itself, when there was a lockdown, it launched 42 direct D2C products. It's, with digitization happening, its supply chain, it's revamped, it's made it more efficient. So my sense is, this is a company which can actually grow at a strong double digit. And it's very attractively priced. It's possibly the I would say, because it grew at just about 6-7% over the last 3 years, it's trading at, a third of the multiples of some of the other consumer businesses. Yeah. And it has return of capital employed of over 30%. So, that's the sort of business it is.
Mm. Well, I guess probably a foreign buyer might have a look at that if he can get these shares, that is, because it's got a good Trojan horse into the Indian economy, isn't it, these sort of stuff?
Yes, I think it's a great business. Yeah.
Yeah. What about Kajaria Ceramics, which does sort of like tiles for sort of bathrooms and domestic. Yeah. I'm guessing this is again another play on the urbanization as people sort of like renovate their houses and also just want new houses.
Yeah. So this is again a market leader. It's a very strong brand. It's a market leader for tiles for bathrooms, flooring, it's ceramic, vitrified tiles. And it's such a dominant player that it spends so much on advertising and brand building that it actually commands a significant price premium, which floats straight into its margins as well. So the story here is really that India historically had a very large unorganized market of people who used to play the, tax arbitrage. So a lot of small players in a particular part of the market. Now that is disappearing because of the new laws of taxation. The tax arbitrage is gone. At the same time, the real estate sector just picked up after a 7-year slump. In fact, last year you had its highest ever residential sales. This year in the last quarter itself, growth was almost 36% in that sector. So you're actually going to see an inflection happening in the growth trajectory. And he's the market leader. I think what's also happened is, we mentioned the supply chain reallocation. The largest supplier of tiles to the US was China. And what's happened is India, as I mentioned, had a lot of these smaller players who used to export largely to the Middle East. What's happened is that shift from the US is moving straight to India. So suddenly these other smaller players are diverting all the capacity to the US market. What it's done is it's got a lot more pricing power in India. So someone like a Kajaria, because he's a very brand conscious premium player, he's not targeting the US market because it's sold to distributors. And he says, I'm not going to sell. I'm only going to sell my brand. Mm. But for him, the whole domestic market has opened up. The competitive environment has come down. So it's a great business. I think it's a well-run company. And it's always commanded that, higher margins because of its brand and pricing power.
Yeah. What about CCL Products, which does a sort of like a roaster and a distributor of coffee, I think, in India, which must be really sort of start. It's a bit like coffee in China. It's a traditional tea drinking nation. And now, I think India quite likes a Johnny Walker Black Label, don't they, as well? But in terms of sort of coffee, that must be sort of becoming far more popular now.
Well, it's interesting you picked this company because it's a very interesting business. This is a company which is has a market cap of $1 billion, but you'd be surprised that it is the largest manufacturer of instant coffee globally after Nestle.
Really? So
it's actually more of an export story.
Right.
In the sense that he has plants in Vietnam and India. And he manufactures instant coffee for global manufacturers. So if you're in Tesco or possibly any of the retail outlets in the UK, their own in-house brand is most likely to be manufactured by CCL and branded and sold to them. So that's the story of this company. It's supplying to hundreds of brands globally, and each one is customized for the end user. So if it's a Tesco, you know, he'll have his own taste customers. So it's very difficult for Tesco to shift to someone else. You know, it's a story where you're actually growing volume at about 15 to 20% per annum. It's a cost plus model, so your earnings grow at the same pace. What you see with this company is that it's actually next year's order book is already full. So, you know, there's very high visibility. What it's doing now is that because it has so much expertise in instant coffee, that he's actually launched his own domestic brand. So he said, till now he was 100% supplying to global players. So he decided, look, let me launch in India. And in India, the coffee market is dominated by, at least the instant coffee is just two brands. There's Nescafe and there's Brew of Unilever. So, you know, and he's already, you know, it's already domestic market is almost, you know, 15% of his revenue. So from being a B2B player, he's actually becoming a B2C player also and getting his own brand. So he's had a lot of success in the 3 years since he's launched. So it's a very interesting model. It's a very safe, very predictable model, a lot of entry barriers. And, you know, where do you get such businesses? And it's you know, and it's just $1 billion. So
I would agree. I mean, what also surprising, one, I've never heard of it because it's the biggest one outside Nestle, but also it actually generates pretty good operating margins for a largely sort of third party distributor owned brand type of manufacturer. It's 16% EBIT margin. So you're right. It's got economies of scale. It's got something there. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what I'm saying, that, you know, you'll get a 16% return on capital employed post tax. That's the sort of model, and growing at 15 to 20%. Yeah. So you just play this growth story. And it's not a stock which trades at 30 or 40 times multiple. It's trading at 20 times, which I think is its value. Yeah. And as, you know, you get conviction on his brand being a leading player in India, you know, you'll see a re-rating also happen.
What about Wellspun, which does sort of textiles and I guess for clothes, that kind of stuff? I don't know if it's workwear or fashion wear or a bit of both.
Wellspun, it's actually the largest home textile company globally. It's a market leader in the US. So it essentially makes towels and bed sheets. So it's a dominant player in the US. In the UK, it owns the Christie's brand. So if you see the Wimbledon towels, it's Wellspun. If you see the Manchester United towels, it's Wellspun.
Right.
So it's a leading textile player globally. Also, I would say it rates among the best textile companies on ESG parameters, etc. So its clients includes the who's who of Walmart, Sportsco, etc. The textile business, if you ask me 4 or 5 years back, used to be a low return on capital employed business, but that has changed. A lot of consolidation has happened in the industry, and Wellspun is a leading player there because they've also moved their model purely to value added. So they've got their own patented products. So some of their towels are called hygrocotton, which is giving them higher margins. And at the same time, they've also gone with their own brand. So to go value-added in India, they've launched their own brands, which are again premium-priced. Mm-hmm. And also to get better shelf space and value-added, so they've partnered with Disney. So all the Disney towels and merchandise you see across Europe, it's again Wellspun. It's tied up with Martha Stewart. What this gives them is more shelf space, more premium products, and gradually keep moving up the value chain. So I think it's a great business model, but this is a slightly more volatile business simply because, you know, there is volatility in cotton prices, which of course are passed through. But this is again a business which today has return ratios of over 14%, and a market leader, and a lot of value on its side.
It seems to be quite a feature, actually, of the India Capital Growth Fund, is that you're not only investing in best-in-class sort of domestic, you know, champions in the small and mid-cap, but actually they're so good. They've got a lot of, you know, sort of applicability outside overseas and probably generating some overseas, you know, revenues as well.
Yeah. You see, India, it's a very interesting market because it's a very diverse market. You have some great businesses with a track record. So, you know, you can actually track the 10-year performance. And as I mentioned that, you know, we always look at the 10-year history. And then you have to have that conviction on the management. Once you've got these two right, I think the opportunity set is huge.
Yeah.
You know, what also happens with India is historically, India used to be a capital scarce economy. So companies have always valued capital. You know, till the 90s, you know, we had capital controls. It was very, very difficult to grow because you didn't have capital. So managements have historically valued capital a lot, which is why you'll find a lot of businesses which have a very high threshold return on capital employed.
Okay, well, let's switch sectors. Another one which is a champion of India is the sort of the healthcare. And it's sort of like people are probably familiar with things like Dr. Reddy's, but you've got a bit, you know, smaller company, Newland Laboratories in there, which I think is, again, is a generics manufacturer for sort of like, you know, drugs around the world, which is, it's a real hotbed, isn't it? Sort of healthcare and biopharma and all this sort of stuff in India.
Yeah. So actually, India is a very large pharmaceutical manufacturing powerhouse. You know, there's Europe, there's China, and there's India. And within that, there are multiple business models. At the top end, you have the formulators who compete with the global players. The moment products go off patent, they launch. Newland is a very niche business. It's a very different business model. What they do is they make what is called active pharmaceutical ingredients. So they don't make the end product, but the core complex chemistries which go into the product. But they have a business, what is called a CRAMS model, which is that they actually partner with global biotech companies in the US, in Japan, in Europe, for the R&D development for new molecules. So they actually go from, you know, preclinical, clinical, phase one, development, commercial. And as the molecule progresses, they are part of that core R&D in the synthesis of the molecule. So they work very closely with innovative companies. And in that whole journey, when a molecule gets commercialized, they become, you know, the supplier of that molecule. And at the same time, they also they have very complex molecules, which they supply to global pharma. And a small portion of the business, which is a generic supplying to everyone, but you're the lowest cost player there. So what's happening is, if you go back 5 years back, at any point of time, they were developing 30 or 40 molecules over different cycles or stage of the development cycle. Today, that number is almost 90 such molecules with different players which they are working on. What is done is a small company like him with about $300 million its revenues. It's got a lot of stability. His margins today are over 30%, which tells you the quality of the business this has. 5 years back, these margins were about 14%. So it's a small niche business, but what used to be volatile is becoming fairly stable, and the pipeline gets bigger and bigger, which gives you even more and more comfort that this is again going to be a longer term story. Now, you know, its market cap is, I think, just about $300 or $400 million. But we got in very early, you know, and as I said, you know, it's all about getting the right management, have that comfort that they're doing the right things. So that's a very interesting model we have. And possibly you're one of the first real investors in this company.
Yeah. Another sort of feature is that you tend to sort of, most of the companies that you own haven't got that much debt either, have they? Basically, they're well capitalized.
Yeah, actually, we are very conscious of leverage. So as I mentioned, you know, there are certain businesses we'll never touch. So, large developers, where the whole model is growth and levered, or businesses where we find a lot of growth but all driven by high working capital or leverage, we're kind of uncomfortable because the risk levels move up. So, as I mentioned, we are very, very comfortable with businesses which generate a lot of free cash. So it's just the nature of investing. We like predictable growing businesses. And hence, wherever the lever, it's just more of a risk. And if we can find better alternatives, why not?
Good. And then another sort of like champion sector for India is the IT outsourcing. You've got a couple of firms here. You've got Tech Mahindra, of probably people know in the UK, and you've also got something smaller, which is Persistent Systems. Do you want to take us through sort of what the attractions are? I'm guessing it's more of sort of the world outsourcing sort of like software writing and all that kind of stuff to India.
So persistent is something we want for a long time. It's actually a very interesting business that it is ha is the most its pedigree is that is the most digitally focused IT company in India, in the sense that the typical Indian IT servicing model is shifting services to India, doing what Persistent used to do was that it used to partner with players like Google, Microsoft, etc., and developing in the core product development phase. So it was actually a IT product development company. So when the move from just pure services to the digitization side of it, this is the company which has actually been able to leverage the most out of it. And it's also revamped its management. They were at a slow growth phase about 3 years back. The management changed, a lot of senior leadership came in. And today, it's the fastest growing IT services company in India, even in an environment where globally all the clients are largely global. And there's a huge focus on cost cutting and growth has slowed down. This is a company which is actually growing its revenues at 15% per annum, even today. And if you look at the IT sector in India, the growth has come down to single digits because of the weakness in the global environment. But this is a company, because it's positioned so strongly on the digitized side of it, it is the fastest growing, and earnings are growing even faster at 20% plus. So I would say, you have to play with the right management, play with the right business, and in a bigger picture, try and get these niches. And when you're looking at the mid caps, possibly the opportunity set is larger, that the growth is higher.
Good. Okay. And I guess sort of, well, Tech Mahindra is more of the sort of the large cap type of IT outsourcer, isn't it? It competes against the likes of I can't remember. There's a number of the big
Yeah,
ones,
it
aren't there?
competes with all the big players, the TCS, Infosys, etc. And it's been one of the weaker performers. Its growth over the last, I would say, 5 years has been in single digits. Largely because he has one big specialty, that he's a dominant player in the telecom space, and that's almost 40% of his revenue. And the story here is that the telecom was globally was going through a tough phase, but with the movement to 5G, that was the next big investment inflection which was going to happen. And Tech Mahindra, as everyone is his client. So that was the inflection point. But having said that, it's been a weak performer for us. The change that's happened is there's again been a new leadership team, and that happened about 3 months back. And so you've had a big change, and you're steadily seeing virtually every business head getting someone from one of the top-end IT companies. And what we've typically seen is whenever there's a leadership change, at least we've seen in the smaller ones, it actually leads to the big inflection in the growth trajectory going forward, because you're able to A, cut costs and take out all the inefficiencies, but also you've hired people who are able to deliver much better going forward. So we have very it's had a poor run within the IT space, but I think it's one where you'll see the maximum inflection going forward.
Well, we'll let you off there, Gaurav, because your portfolio as a total has done really, really well.
Yeah.
So even the best investors don't have everything going their right way, but it looks good for the future.
Yeah.
Just on electronic sort of contract manufacturer, you've got Dixon Technologies in there, which I guess is going to benefit people like, you know, Apple moving its iPhone to India. Yeah. I did notice, I mean, as typical sort of the industry, the margins are quite slim though, aren't they?
Yeah. Actually, Dixon is like the it's the Foxconn of India, I would call it.
Right.
It's the largest player in India in the electronic manufacturing space. Now, I'll give you a perspective of the opportunity. Its revenue is about $2 billion. If you take Foxconn, its global revenue is about $200 billion plus.
Mm.
Now, Dixon is the largest for lighting, so it supplies 70% of the market is held by them. They supply to everyone from Philips, etc. It supplies televisions to Samsung and Xiaomi. It's the largest washing machine player, supplies to Panasonic. What has happened is the inflection that's happening today is it's gone into phone manufacturing. And I did mention Motorola.
Yeah.
So Motorola is shifting 25% of its manufacturing to him for the global and domestic requirements. Likewise, he's got Xiaomi, he's got Nokia for mobiles. He's just gone into refrigerators. He's got into the new wave is in manufacturing. Laptops. So, you know, Acer has already signed up with him. So huge inflection in growth trajectory. I mean, this is a company where we are actually expecting the next 2 years to see an earnings compounding at over 50% over the next 2 years.
Okay.
Because these are big, you know, when you're talking about volumes, you know, you're talking about millions of phones a month being churned out. So every incremental account is big. He's not into Apple simply because Apple is sourcing from its three big global suppliers who've set up shop here. But incrementally, he's getting a lot of other business. And virtually every 2 weeks, you hear a new deal being struck by this company. So the game is really about top-line growth and execution. I think the margin profile of this business is going to be low at just about 4.5%.
Yeah.
But what they're also doing is they're gradually adding more and more value. So they'll get into the back end in terms of from assembling to making PCBs to making plastic components. So it's a huge runway of growth in this segment.
Good. Okay. Well, just turn to the final sort of sector, which is infrastructure and industrials. We've got PSP projects. So we've got Skipper, which does engineering products. And then we've got Ramkrishna Forgings. Do you want to start off with PSP? Sort of projects, which I guess is a traditional sort of like, you know, sort of contractor for infrastructure, builds bridges, roads, rail, that kind of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, it's a very simple business. He's a pure construction company, but he's not into projects which deal largely with a lot of these government roads, etc. What he does is he started off as for construction, office buildings, office complexes, or plants for offices. So he started making for pharmaceutical companies in the state of Gujarat. And he did such a good job that he keeps getting repeat orders. His customers include even companies like Nestle for their plants and office complexes. And then as he kept getting bigger and bigger, and as scale happened, the size of projects increased. So today he's done a lot of hospitals, a lot of educational institutes, and his order books have been increasing steadily to the extent that as you grow in size, what happens, you're able to bid for larger and larger projects. Mm-hmm. He's done some very marquee projects. For example, in the city of Surat, he's done the Diamond Boss, that's the Diamond Exchange, which is the largest single office building in size globally. It's bigger than the Pentagon. So, you know, he's made a lot of marquee projects, and it's a small company. It's a $300 million market cap company. But what is the focus is on execution. So you've got steady margins, business which is growing at about 15% per annum. So it's again feeds our bill of, you know, a steady earnings growth story, a conservative guy taking projects which he knows have low risk and you're not stuck to, government which don't pay you, etc. So very, very conscious guy, focused a lot on the private sector, but within the government sector also, it's a very, where the projects are funded by the World Bank or something, so he knows his cash flows are there, it's secure.
Good. What about Skipper, which does a sort of engineering products, I think, for all kinds of stuff, I guess, also for factories, I imagine.
Actually, Skipper is into what you call manufacturing transmission towers, telecom towers. It's
Okay.
a 100% backward integrated business. So he does all the joints, etc., himself. And he's the lowest cost player globally. Now, the story was that in India itself, you're having a lot of investments in transmission and power, etc. And he used to also export to the East Asian countries and Africa. What's happened for him is that ever since this China-US trade war started, a lot of global companies in the new tenders are saying they want no component from China. So for someone like a Skipper, suddenly his export market has totally opened up. To give a perspective, he never in Australia is investing a lot in the power transmission. Earlier, everything was sourced from China. Today, it's all banned from China. So he's become a big supplier. In the US, he's got all his regulatory approvals. And as I mentioned, again, all incremental is coming from out of China, is moving to countries like India. And as I mentioned, he's the lowest cost player. Now, what's happened is even Chinese companies which are implementing projects in Africa, etc., are sourcing from him because he's actually much cheaper. So this is a company which is actually telling me today that, they're focusing only on profitability because there is absolutely no shortage of orders. Since the domestic market is booming, the global market is booming. He's, found registrations across Europe, US, everywhere. So it's a classic case where he's saying, look, orders is the least of my problems. It's all about profitability and, picking and choosing what you want.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you, it's very nice, sort of like a problem to have, a position to be in, isn't it? When you've got sort of unlimited demand, that's for sure. And then just finally, we've got Ramkrishna Forgings, which I think makes forgings for sort of like probably the automotive sector, rail sector, and transport in general, I guess.
So he makes forgings for largely for commercial vehicles. And this is again a company which over the last 4 5 years has not just expanded its range of products, but its client base. For example, earlier it was 70% domestic focused. Today it's almost 50% is domestic. The balance is exports. He's again winning new clients. He's got the presses fully automated, 12,000 ton presses. His from being today, I would say he used to be largely in the automotive space and commercial vehicle space, but within autos, he's moved to even four-wheelers, cars. He's got into railways, he's gone into oil and gas, he's gone into mining equipment. So what are the a very commercial vehicle dependent business today is actually diversified into commercial vehicles globally in India and a wider spectrum. His margins, which used to be about 20%, today are trending at 23-24% because exports have a higher margin percentage. And of course, you keep getting into higher and higher value products by, through machining, etc. Now, again, this is another company which is actually gaining out of this supply chain reallocation because new orders for new platforms, what companies are seeing is finding sources out of China. So he's getting business from LATAM, etc. So it's a whole host of companies in India actually benefiting out of it. So in a very slow global environment, you're finding a lot of portfolio companies of ours are seeing the exports really picking up. So
Yeah,
really
when
you
you
have to, So it's really picking these niches and you find such strong leaders in the small and mid-cap space.
Yeah. Now, I think if you combine sort of entrepreneurial talent at the top and founder-led businesses with a lot of passion and drive, plus you've got unlimited demand overseas, then it's a great combination to at least vest in, that's for sure. Now, I had a look at sort of like investing into individual stocks in India through the UK platforms, Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ, but it's impossible to do so. So if people wanted to put money into the India Capital Growth Fund, how best to do that, Gaurav?
Well, we're a fund listed on the London Stock Exchange, so you can go through any of the brokers, AJ Bell, etc. And I
You're an
mean, if you can,
investment trust, I think, aren't you? Is that right?
yes, we are an investment trust listed on the LSE. So I think it's fairly easy
Good.
to purchase the trust on the stock exchange.
Well, I'll definitely have a good look because I wish I'd done it 5 years ago. It certainly helped my portfolio through the pandemic, that's for sure. So, thanks very much for the insights, Gaurav, into India and all the things investing within the country. And look forward again in touching base probably in about 3 or 6 months' time.
Great. Thanks, Paul. And hopefully the story will look even better 3 months from now.
Sounds good.
Great. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.